9:10 up to 9:50. From 10 past 10, we'll have a presentation by Association of Christian Media until half past 10. From 11 o'clock to 20 past 11, presentation by AfriForum. And then from 12 o'clock to 20 past 12, presentation by COSAT. I'm not very sure whether we need to introduce each other. My name is Jerome Maggi. I'm the chairperson of the ADO committee.
Good morning. I'm Diane Kohler-Barnard, a member of the committee. Thank you.
My name is Dirk Stiller. Good morning to everybody. I'm also a member of this committee.
Good morning, Chairperson, and honorable members. I'm Calvin Mangani, Committee Manager.
Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Martin Janani. I'm the legal support of the committee. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Nomudela Sombech. I'm the content advisor.
Good morning, Chair and members. Blalem Jans van Rijnsburg. I'm the content advisor assisting the committee.
Morning, Chair. Tebolo, the member of the committee.
Can we then go directly to the presentation by the F.W. de Klerk Foundation? Over to you.
Thank you. Good morning, Honourable Chair and committee members. I am just confirming that everyone can see my slides.
Yes, we can.
Okay, fantastic. I'm Daniela Ellebeck, an attorney and the Constitutional Programs Manager at the F.W. de Klerk Foundation. Joining me is my learned colleague, Mr. Ismail Yusuf, the Constitutional Programs Legal Officer. We have previously had the privilege of addressing this committee at the public hearings on this bill. Now, the Foundation is a non-profit organization dedicated to upholding South Africa's constitution. And our vision is to make our constitutional democracy a reality for all South Africans. To this end, the Foundation seeks to promote the constitution and the values, rights, and principles it enshrines by, inter alia, monitoring developments, including legislation and policy, that have the potential to affect the constitution or its values, rights, and principles. The Foundation does so in the interest of everyone in South Africa. We welcome the opportunity to make this concise oral submission to the committee, trusting it will be of assistance in guiding the committee in its deliberations regarding this bill, with its broad surveillance scope that risks eroding privacy, empowering state interference, stifling dissent, endangering democratic principles, and raising concerns about abuse. Now the GILA aims to amend three intelligence laws: the National Strategic Intelligence Act of 1994, the Intelligence Services Act of 2002, and the Intelligence Services Oversight Act of 1994. Now, the principal acts, as they would read, once they have been amended by the GILA, as it currently stands in this version in front of the committee, were
I don't see your slide rolling. You're still on the very same slide.
Yes, Chairperson, it is meant to be on that slide. There's no technical fault.
We've got the hard copies. You can continue.
Fantastic. Thank you, Alita, for distributing the hard copies as well. So the principal acts, Chairperson and honourable committee members, as they would read once they have been amended by the GILA and its current version in front of this committee, were attached to the Foundation's written submission made to this committee as Annex A. Now, the changes that the bill sought to introduce into each act were inserted and highlighted in yellow. And we trust that this would be a valuable resource to the committee members, allowing them to see the bill's cumulative effects if the changes were to be made to these laws. Now, the Foundation is concerned that the bill's proposed changes that it's asking Parliament to make will directly infringe upon various constitutional rights, including the rights to privacy, freedom of expression, political rights, freedom of occupation and trade, and access to courts and enforcement of rights, which I will just call access to justice. Now, as this Honourable Committee is aware, the state is bound constitutionally to not only uphold these rights, but also to respect, protect, and promote them. And should the state wish to limit any of these rights in the Bill of Rights, it may only do so in accordance with Section 36 of the Constitution. Now, turning to the Foundation's substantive concerns about the bill, these can be divided into two main categories. The first is the bill's problematic definitions. And the second is the fact that the bill makes it compulsory for the state intelligence agency to conduct vetting investigations on persons or institutions suspected of being threats or potential threats to national security. And these vetting investigations will be done to determine these people or institutions' security competence for purposes of obtaining a security clearance certificate. Now, turning to the first category, the problematic definitions. First and foremost, the term threat, a crucial concept underpinning the entire bill and various definitions, is undefined. And I pause to mention here that this crucial concept is also undefined in all the principal acts. Now, the Foundation's proposed definition for threat is found on the right-hand column of that table. The second is the definition of threat to national security, which is defined as including subversion and undue influence by hostile interests on government processes, policies, and sovereignty of the state and its organs. However, because the bill fails to define either threat or to exclude and protect lawful activity, advocacy, protest, or dissent, as I pause to mention it does do elsewhere, the result is an overbroad definition that could potentially include citizens or institutions who oppose policies, regulations, draft laws, such as this very bill, that the government wishes to adopt. And as such, threat to national security could include civil society. Turning to the definition for personal institution of national security interest, this definition is extremely concerning because it rests on two problematic concepts. The first is that these are people or institutions whose activities are deemed by the intelligence agency to be inconsistent with Section 198 of the Constitution. However, any action that is seen as affecting South Africans' resolve to live as equals, in peace and harmony, be free from fear and want, and to seek a better life is contrary to Section 198 of the Constitution. These vague concepts mean that anything could be seen as contrary to Section 198 of the Constitution, and therefore anyone who catches the agency's interest could be said to be a personal institution of national security interest. And the unintended consequences, Honourable Committee members, of such an overbroad definition could be that there is no sphere of the public realm, whether that be education institutions, private businesses, journalists and media, or civil society organisations and their employees, that will be safe from the agency's prying eyes. Now, the second problem is that these activities include, but are not limited to, activities that are defined as a threat to national security, which, going back to our previous slide, is problematic for the reasons we canvassed, namely the fact that this fails to exclude lawful political activity, advocacy, protest, or dissent. Turning to the definitions for national security and opportunity or potential threat, both of these are highly problematic because they are circular. And circular definitions are definitions that rely on themselves or other undefined terms within the same context, thereby creating an endless loop of interpretation. Now, I'm going to turn to the next slide, which I hope clearly shows why these definitions for national security and opportunity or potential opportunity are circular. First of all, we can see that in clause 1M, the GILAD defines national security as, quote, the capabilities, measures, and activities of the state to pursue or advance any threat, any potential threat, any potential opportunity, or the security of the public and its people, in or outside the Republic, in accordance with Section 198 of the Constitution, end quote. Turning to Clause 1O of the Bill, which defines opportunity or potential opportunity, we see that it's defined as, subject to the Bill of Rights and the principles enshrined of the Constitution, such capability measures or activity employed to pursue and advance national security in accordance with Section 198 of the Constitution. Now, Honourable Committee members, the result, if you plug these respective definitions into one another, is a circular definition that reads as follows. For national security, you get a definition that says, the capabilities, measures, and activities of the state to pursue or advance any threat, any potential threat, national security, or the security of the Republic and its people. And for opportunity or potential opportunity, you get a definition that reads, such capability, measures, or activity employed to pursue or advance any threat, any potential threat, any opportunity, any potential opportunity. So what we see is that an opportunity or potential opportunity is effectively defined as any opportunity or any potential opportunity that the state pursues. Now, first, this definition is unworkable because it's open to abuse due to its circularity. The second is that the concept of potential threat or potential opportunity is redundant, as I would submit to the Honourable Committee that both threat and opportunity are concepts by their very definition, which are potential danger and a potential good, respectively. Third, the intelligence agency seems to have carte blanche in deciding what wasn't deemed as either a threat or an opportunity, as the bill fails to provide any factors, in other words, any parameters, to be considered in the identification of either of these. National security is similarly defined as the pursuit or advancement of national security. Now, not only is this unworkable and open to abuse due to its circularity, but it's arbitrary and thus irrational, and because of this, it fails to comply with the Republic's founding value found in Section 1C of the Constitution, namely the rule of law, making it unconstitutional. Turning to the definitions of domestic intelligence, foreign intelligence, intelligence gathering, and national security intelligence, all of these include and rely on the concepts of threat or opportunity or potential opportunity or threat or potential threat to national security. Now, due to the problems with these concepts, as already canvassed, these definitions are overbroad and unworkable and open to abuse. Turning to the definition for security competency test. Now, the bill currently reads as follows. Secure competency test means a ministry availing investigation to determine the security competence of a personal institution and if such a personal institution is suitable to access classified information or critical infrastructure of the state or is viewed as vulnerable to blackmail, undue influence, or manipulation, or security compromise, or is a personal institution of national security interest in terms of Section 428I of the Act. Now, this disjunctive reading, in other words, the use of or as opposed to and of the various factors, makes the definition of security competence test overbroad, because literally, Honourable Committee members, every citizen in the Republic can be deemed to be vulnerable to, for example, manipulation. But that does not mean that they are a threat to national security or that they should be able to administer a security competency test on them. This disjunctive reading results in the clause failing to achieve its purpose, which is no doubt only to bear individuals with access to classified information and critical infrastructure of the state, not every single citizen in the Republic. And the clause's failure to achieve its purpose results in an arbitrary infringement of the various rights and a failure of the justification analysis contained in Section 36(1) of the Constitution. Turning to the second category of the Foundation's problems with the bill, the compulsory vetting. Now, as can be seen from these slides, the bill makes it compulsory for the agency to conduct vetting investigation to determine the security competence of a person or institution suspected of being a threat or potential threat to national security. for the purposes of issuing a security clearance certificate. Now, the result is that due to the wide definitions of threats to national security and national security, these clauses would allow for civil society organizations and those working for them to be seen by the intelligence agency as persons or institutions of national security interest and to be subjected to a vetting investigation to determine their security competence. In other words, should they be granted the security clearance certificate or not? Now, should a person or institution of national security interest, in other words, an external person who does not have access to classified information and is not capable of espionage, be seen as acting inconsistent with Section 198 of the Constitution or as a threat to national security, they would fail to get the security clearance certificate. The implied risk of failing to obtain such a certificate is that if you're an organization, you would no longer be able to continue operations. And possibly, if you're a national person, you may even face criminal prosecution as a terrorist. Now, turning to one last problem that I just wish to highlight briefly, and I'm sure many of the other stakeholders will go into this in depth, so I'm just going to name this briefly and flag it for the committee, is the Bill's failure to comply with constitutional court judgments. Now, the committee is no doubt aware of the matter of Amar Bugani Centre for Investigative Journalism and another versus the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services, which was a matter in which judgment was handed down in 2021. Now, in this matter, the Crown Court held that RICA, the Regulation of Interception of Communications and Provisions of Communication-Related Activities Act of 2002, was unconstitutional because it failed to provide full post-surveillance notification to the people who had been subject of the surveillance. And the court said that this failure amounted to an unjustifiable infringement of their constitutional rights to privacy and access to justice. Now, the bill contains the same failure and is therefore prima facie unconstitutional. Now, in summary, the bill will result in the state being able to spy on anyone it sees to be a threat to national security without ever having to tell the people spied upon that it had done so. A threat to national security because of the problematic definition would include civil society, activists, religious organizations, media, journalists, and even private businesses. All of this makes the bill open to abuse by any future government wishing to threaten or even silence critical voices opposed to it. Should the state wish to limit constitutional rights, it may only do so in accordance with Section 36 of the Constitution, which amongst others requires consideration of the nature and extent of the limitation, the relationship with the limitation and its purpose. And given the fact that, for example, many of the clauses failed to achieve their purpose, this bill would fail to meet the Section 36(1) justification analysis. Also, by failing to define the parameters of what is used to determine if someone is a threat, and by including vague and overbroad definitions which are open to abuse, the bill fails to pass the Section 36 limitation test. Due to the circularity of many definitions, it also fails to comply with the rule of law, which is a founding value of the Constitution. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you very much. I think now would be the time from members to interrogate or to comment questions on the presentation. Honourable Kola Barnett.
Good morning to you, and thank you very much for your in-depth presentation. In your analysis of what was put before you, I see that you have looked forward to the implications for many entities, although it was originally categorically stated that heads of churches, heads of NGOs had to be vetted. That was then deemed to be unconstitutional by Parliament and taken out. But it does seem to me, and I see it possibly seems to you as well, that it is put back in another form. which could be interpreted to be exactly what was taken out and unconstitutional in itself. So I'm interested in your input on that. I don't personally think the bill as it stands would fly and would be challenged in the Constitutional Court. Is that your opinion too? Thank you.
Are there any other questions, Honourable Chairperson, or shall I have Lee to go ahead and ask and answer Honourable Crawford Barnum?
Any other questions? I don't see any other hands. You can go ahead whilst they are still thinking.
Okay. If the host can just enable screen sharing again, please. That will enable me to go to a slide that will help me answer Honourable Crawford Barnard's question. But Honourable Crawford Barnard, you are correct in saying that the first version of the bill that was given to Parliament included expressly that NGOs, non-governmental organisations and religious institutions had to be vetted. And committee members and viewers might remember that there was a big outcry from the NGO sector as well as the religious sector saying, but why are we now needing to be vetted by the spies as well, which is essentially what the intelligence agency and the intelligence services are. And that specific clause was taken out of the bill. However, what we see being put back into the bill is, if we turn to this slide, we see the definition of a personal institution of national security interest being the phrase that replaced that express provision that mandated that religious institutions and NGOs be vetted. Now, a personal institution of national security interest, because of the fact that it hinges on Section 198 of the Constitution, which again includes vague concepts open to abuse, and because of the fact that it fails to exclude lawful political activity, advocacy, protest, or dissent, actually goes much wider in the Foundation's analysis. Because now not only do you get NGOs and religious institutions in the net, and I've forced to point out that non-governmental organizations, NGOs, are a wide variety of entities, so that is a very large source of society. It's not as focused as saying, for example, a non-profit company or a trust or anything like that. It's a generic term that encompasses a lot. But here, with personal institutional national security interest, because literally any activity could be seen to fall within Section 198 if the intelligence agency doesn't like it, and because it expressly fails to exclude lawful political activity, advocacy, protest, or dissent, which, again, I just wish to point out, it expressly fails to do so when it comes to personal institutional national security interest, even though it does exclude it somewhere else in the bill in relation to another matter. So it is something that was thought of and was decided not to be included for personal institution of national security interest, but which the Foundation would argue definitely needs to be included. And as a result of both of these concepts, they actually go much farther and wider than just NGOs and religious institutions. And now all of a sudden we see it affecting the media and journalists. We see it affecting educational institutions, political parties, all of that. And again, that is why in the right-hand column, the Foundation proposes that any personal institution of national security interest should be amended to read is a personal institution suspected of espionage, which is clearly what the bill should be focused on, because PLAB defines espionage as unlawful and intentional communication, delivery, or making available classified information to directly or indirectly benefit a foreign state personal institution. And that should be what is a personal institution of national security interest, not journalists, not religious organizations, not civil society. And then in answer to your question of whether or not this bill will fail to pass constitutional muster, I do agree with you. I said out in our presentation for various reasons. Not only does it fail to comply with the rule of law, which it needs to comply with in terms of the Constitution, but it also fails to pass the Section 36 justification analysis to limit the right to privacy, the right to access to justice, freedom of occupation of trade, freedom of expression, association, all of those rights. as set out in our presentation. Any further questions?
Just a clarification on your presentation, point number 18, remedies. Your proposed definition or action. Can I just find out your proposed definitions or action? Are they different from what is in the bill? Did you make some amendments? Because I was looking at threats to national security and check 1TF. I don't see any additions or amendments. It's exactly the same as the one that is in the bill itself. So just to clarify, your proposed definitions, are they different? If you could clarify me on that one. Thank you.
Honorable Chairperson, you are referring to our written submission, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, fantastic. 1TF does have a difference in it. If Honorable Chairperson will look at threat to national security, it includes that phrase that we have been mentioning in our oral presentation, the fact that a threat to national security must be seen to not include lawful political activity, advocacy, protest, or dissent. So that's what was added into the proposed remedy, is that we need to include that phrase into threat to national security, because otherwise threat to national security will be seen as including lawful political activity, advocacy, protest, or dissent, and it can't seem to do that, because otherwise it will see everyone as participating in this public hearing, in this oral submission on this bill, for example, as a threat to national security, which obviously is not the purpose of this law.
Thank you very much. I think there's a bit of confusion here. The bill that was submitted to Parliament, the one that we have ourselves, I understand there was some other bill that went to the public, but that is not the bill that we have that was submitted to Parliament. So in the one that was submitted to Parliament, the clause is exactly the same as you wrote here. So seemingly, well, I would understand that. It's not a problem there. Thank you very much. Any other questions from members?
Yes, Chair, if you give me permission.
Oh, I forgot to introduce you. I was just about to do that. You can go ahead.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Honourable Chair, will the de Klerk Foundation be happy with self-regulation? We know that doctors, lawyers, many other people in our society, they have self-regulation to prevent harm to others. So we do realize that harm to our security is critical, especially now that there is a process of a regime change taking place in South Africa, and the Minister of Intelligence is concerned about it. I can understand that vetting is something that is being considered. But I want to speak on behalf of my constituency, Imams Maulana Sheikhs. It is unacceptable for us that they be vetted. They are appointed by God. The security agency can't act as God. And similarly, other religious groups, the appointments are sacred appointments. And vetting should to address the fears that our security agents seem to have the drafters, they should rather look at self-regulation, like for doctors and lawyers and others. Why must religious leaders, for example, why must the board members of NGO give up their free time serving the community, supplementing the efforts of government, serving good causes? Why must they be vetted by security forces, by intelligence forces?
Honorable Hendrix, just a minute. I'm getting a bit confused here. I would understand that you are deliberating now. You are not asking a question. And as a member of this committee, can we do that after receiving all the presentations? And we do that in the deliberations as a committee. I see you are now presenting.
Mr. Chairman, you're quite correct. I apologize. The question was, we have the Declare Foundation here. They've done a lot of work in this area to guide me when I'm going to deliberate as a member of the committee. I wanted to know, how do they feel about self-regulation rather than vetting?
Over to you for the answer.
All right. Honourable Chairperson, just firstly, turning to your question on the definition, I know that it gets a bit technical, but when I look at the bill as it was opened up for comment on the website, it does not exclude lawful political activity or such if I look at Threat to National Security TF, which is what we are proposing it needs to expressly exclude. So that's the only difference when it comes to that specific definition. Honourable Hendrick, when it comes to self-regulation for the religious community, I'm sure that Freedom of Religion South Africa will be dealing with that. Specifically when it comes to the whole of South Africa, what I am saying is, and what the foundation is saying, is that the definitions need to be tightened up, because otherwise this bill is going to catch everyone in its net. And the spies should not be spying on everyone and never telling them that they've been spied upon, which is the effect of what this bill will have. The spies should be spying on people that are suspected of espionage. Now, bear in mind that we already have other laws that everyone needs to adhere to, such as, for example, the TARA, Protection of Constitutional Democracy Against Terrorism and Related Activities Act, the Anti-Money Laundering Act, and a host of other laws that would already catch in their net in the other illegal activities. So by monitoring through SOAP on the street, the state doesn't gain anything. This bill needs to be focused. It needs to only look at people that actually are a threat to national security. So that needs to define what a threat is, and it needs to make sure that it doesn't include civil society organizations that are participating in the lawful process and not breaking any other laws in doing so. I hope that answers the question. But I would say I do very strongly agree with Honourable Hendrix that religious leaders should not be vetted by our intelligence agencies. We're a democracy, and we should protect our freedoms.
Thank you very much. As I said earlier on, there seemed to be a confusion there, because in this bill that we received in Parliament, there's nowhere where I see religious leaders in there. But in any way, any other questions from members? If not, then thank you very much for the presentation, and all the inputs are going to be taken into consideration in the deliberations for the bill. Thank you very much. You are released, if that is the right term. Can we now, do we need a 5 minutes break before the second submission? I had a yes.
I'm speaking on behalf of the Association of Christian Media, which is an association of 70 organizations which include community radio, magazines, television and other content providers. I'm going to be looking at our motivation, both in terms of the Bible and from specific case examples, as to why it is really important to fix this bill, and I'm also going to be answering the question just asked by the chairman to this the previous speaker, and then I'm going to look at the bill in terms of where we believe there are problems that could be exploited and misused in a way that could be harmful to religious freedom and also to freedom more generally, and then to give some recommendations to improve this. But I also appreciate the many wonderful submissions that have been made by other organizations which have printed out and I'm studying, which go into more detail. If I could start off with the question of why does this matter? We are all under a lot of time pressure, and why should we give our attention to fixing this when we're in a hurry before the elections to get a whole lot of things done? The first issue is the motivation in terms of the Bible. The important principles to draw from the Bible is firstly that the church is meant to be independent of the state. Secondly, that the state does not have the capacity to define what the church is or what is the true church. And so all that they can do is to allow general freedom for everybody in order to preserve that independence of the church and of religion. One therefore needs to have concentric circles of freedom around the church and religious freedom and general freedom of speech and political freedom. Coupled with that is the teaching of the Bible of a very pessimistic view of human nature. Now, I think it's easy for us to be pessimistic about other people's teams, that they might do something wrong. But it's more difficult for us to be pessimistic that our own team might do something wrong. But I think the Bible teaches us, and human history teaches us, that very often our own team, even our own political party or our own religious organization, can abuse power and do bad things. So with that pessimistic view, we then need to look at the legislation in terms of what can go wrong. The first case example that I'm going to put forward, if I could go back to the two prize slides previously, is the example of a mentor of mine, whose name was Hugh Wetmore. Could I go one back? And he was the leader of the Evangelical Alliance, who during the apartheid era was doing very similar work to what I'm doing now in making presentations to government, motivating for things. And they spied on him his entire life, even before he got into that leadership role, from when he was a student. And at one point he went and saw that his mail was being tampered with, and so he laid a charge against the security police, who then called him in and then told him his life story, and he found out that all sorts of people that he thought were his friends were actually spies working for the security police who were infiltrating these various organizations. And then they tried to recruit him to be a spy as well, to give them information, which he refused, but then he forgot about the charge that he had laid against them because he was intimidated by that. And I think you can appreciate that would be intimidating to many people. I think I've also had from one of the members of this committee told me that they had been had a similar experience from that security police. Do we want that sort of intrusive security apparatus restored to this country? No, I don't think we do. But we've got other countries, for example, Russia and China, that have even more intrusive state security. And we have a great leap forward in the last few years with technology that enables them to be 1,000 times more intrusive than they could have been 5 years ago because of the ability of surveillance, firstly, and secondly, artificial intelligence to analyze that surveillance, which is being used very effectively to intrusively monitor the Chinese population, which we definitely don't want here. Now, one can take the example, one can say, okay, that's an extreme example, but we also have the book, for example, Spycatcher, which was written by an ex-MI5 person in Britain, which is a liberal democracy, who says that his intelligence agency abused their powers in order to get information in their government's negotiation with other countries that so that they spied on the places that the bugged the rooms that they were talking in, and that can prejudice the entire political process. Then we have, moving forward to the next slide, the context of a raft of legislation, each of which is eroding slightly the freedoms of individuals and giving more power to the state. So we don't want to look at this bill alone, we want to see it in the context of a whole raft of bills and policies that are coming in at the same time. Now this is what happened in China to Hong Kong, which was handed over in 1997, and it was slowly eroded, next slide, until 2020 their political freedoms were entirely lost. Now, the thing is that each of these constitute a lever of power, and if enough levers of power can be concentrated in the hands of any individual, you have the or group, then the opportunity is that the entire system of constitutional order starts to break down. So we've got the Gilab or Spy Bill, we've got the Hate Speech Bill, which is restricting freedom of speech, we've got the Film and Publication Act, which is also doing that in some of its clauses. We've got the Equality Amendment Bill, which is in the pipeline, which is very intrusive into every business and organization. We've got the Bella Education Bill, which is taking away powers from parents and giving it to the state. And I could list many more, but put those all together and you've got an erosion of freedom. Now, the context is also that we have extreme time frames in order to get this done, and I was told there's the intention to voting on this bill through the National Assembly early next month. I don't believe there is time for the committee to apply their minds in that situation, and I would say that we really have a wealth of input from the different organizations, but we need to take these things and get the best out of each of these submissions and put it convert it into amendments. Then you as leaders need to decide which ones you want to propose, and then they need to be deliberated on and then voted on before it goes to Parliament. Otherwise, there cannot be a proper application of mind. So now if we firstly go then into the specific issues that are in question, the question was asked, why are we concerned about vetting of religious organizations? The answer is that we believe that although that specific mandate, Mr. Chairman, we're thankful that that was removed from the bill, it could still be done because these definitions are so broad, and I can give you examples of how other people have interpreted these same words in a way that compromises freedom, and they could do that exactly the same way again. Where one's got many different clauses linked together, next slide please, which one has to look at together, and I will go over some of the same territory as of the previous speaker. Yeah, that is Hong Kong, which has lost its freedom. I will also note, for example, that France has had six republics. That means the republic lost its constitutional order five times already. The same can happen to this country. We mustn't be over-optimistic. So if one goes through, next slide, this spiderweb of, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but these are many interconnected legal references and references to other bills. You put them together and it leaves it wide open for somebody who wants to abuse power or could abuse power, even with some noble motive of wanting to improve society. Next slide, please. So to give examples of this, we've got the threat to national security has a number of criteria, which some of which are legitimate. So if somebody is plotting violence or is threatening violence, by all means, let state security investigate that person and see what they're doing. But the first two criteria are threats to equality and threats to peace and harmony. Now, I can see why they put that in. They took it from Section 198 of the Constitution, but the way it's put into the bill is not achieving the purpose that it's intended in Section 198 of the Constitution. If challenge to equality means challenging the right to everybody to have a vote, then, you know, that's fair enough. But there are many different interpretations of the meaning of equality, and people have different opinions on that. And I can give an example of a UWC law student recently was threatened by his own lecturers in terms of not graduating because he had expressed opinions on social media that they considered to be not compatible with equality. So that includes the opinion on gender roles in the family, abortion, LGBT. Now, to me, that is a completely wrong interpretation, but these are law professors who have interpreted it this way. We've got students who've been thrown out of UCT law faculty for presenting a pro-life viewpoint, for example, okay, because they are intolerant of this. So there are people around who can misinterpret that. Likewise, the second category, peace and harmony, in the context of Section 198, that is meant to mean the opposite of armed conflict, which is fine. If somebody's threatening armed conflict, investigate them. But the wording doesn't say that. So either change it to mean threat of armed conflict or delete it, because otherwise somebody's going to interpret that to say, well, anybody who's saying something controversial can then be monitored or vetted by state security. Now, I'd also say that there's an enormous difference between vetting, which is prior to a person's appointment, and vetting everybody, or checking somebody after there's an identified threat. It's likewise compared to with censorship. If you want to pre-publication censor every newspaper, that is a serious problem, as has happened in the past and in other countries. But if you then have repercussions for if somebody publishes something that after the fact, well, that's less intrusive. So vetting is much more dangerous than just investigation. Then I think the misuse of the reference to Section 198 of the Constitution, in my view, that is the maximum scope of this, all of the security services in South Africa. It's not a mandate for investigation. So the mandate for investigation or spying needs to be narrower, and the mandate for vetting needs to be even narrower than that. Then in terms of the definitions, the word opportunity in Section 1, M, and O can be anything. And I think the word opportunity is also used elsewhere in the thing. So please take out opportunities. Please take out this thing, equality or and peace and harmony, or otherwise define it much more narrowly. Then there's the argument that, you know, security must be defensive. So it's responding to a threat. We don't want, you know, them running after any good idea that they want to look at. And I think they're going to have enough work to look after real threats in this country. Then there's the question of the definition of the person of national security interest, and the chairman asked this question. So if you look at 1P, it's got it's got two words which are all and including. So that means that it can be either one, not both. Okay? And So, and then if one looks at just the principles in Section 198 of the Constitution, that is even broader, and that includes even beyond the Equality Act, the Equality Section 9, to the sort of the pursuit of opportunities for equal. So that is incredibly broad. That is not the intention of Section 198, that all of those people can be made a person of national security interest. I would say that one wants to look at certain critical people who may be giving out government tenders or in military roles or something like that, but not somebody who makes threats, but not everybody in the country. Now, this next slide, please. This bill expands the powers of the state, and okay, that's an illustration of two photographs of the same object. The one is a vague photograph, the other is clear, and my encouragement is that we make all the definitions clear. I think the previous speaker also referred to that. Next slide, please. So then there's the question of the expansion of the powers of the state, and my argument is that if the powers of the state are going to be expanded, then there needs to be also a corresponding strengthening of the controls on the state spy agency. So the expansion, including the co-option of the private security regulator. Now, that is massive. You know, those people have security cameras surveillancing every car license registration in the country. The Chinese are using that for facial recognition. There's more people employed by that than the military. Then there's mass surveillance, which can be interception of signals, they can tell who you're phoning or who you're connected with, and process that through artificial intelligence. Then the exchange of information with the government, now other government departments. So the government department can request spying. Now, that can in some situations be reasonable, but other situations it might not be reasonable. So, for example, we don't want the education department spying on education NGOs to see what they're up to. That would be not fair. Likewise, if the spy agency is going to request information from other government departments, then there needs to be control on that, because otherwise your personal information has been compromised. So those things need to be balanced. And I listened on the 7th of December to presentation by the Inspector General's office, which I was impressed by. I would love to have a written copy of what he said, but he did raise two issues. The one issue was his independence of the State Department, that he was monitoring a department that he was in fact subordinate to, and I think that is a good rational argument. The second issue is that he wanted binding recommendations, and I think that is fair enough, but there's a counter argument that I think the chairman raised, which is that it could be unreasonable recommendations, and so maybe there needs to be a process to resolve that, but I think that those are good and reasonable arguments. But then I'd also come to the question of interpretation of this, and I think that you may have good intent in the way that this bill is worded, but somebody is going to come along and interpret it differently in the way that I have suggested that they could do badly. And in my experience in being involved in such processes for 30 years now, every time we've thought something bad could be interpreted in something, somebody has interpreted it exactly that way. Maybe there's been a lawsuit brought or some government official has interpreted in the bad way. So it's not unrealistic that somebody could do that, and we want to close that opportunity. So in conclusion, please, the threats, remove A and B, or define them narrowly, remove opportunities, strengthen the office of the Inspector General, although I believe there can be negotiation as to how that is done, but what he said seemed to me to be plausibly sensible. And then in terms of this, these powers, additional powers of exchanges with other departments and mass surveillance, one wants to look at how that can be balanced. And I haven't managed to fully read through all of these other submissions, but I've been really impressed by them, and I think that as we work through that, we can find it. But really, I'd ask your committee to make time for yourselves. I don't believe you have time to do that by early March, and I think you need at least a month on this. I'm informed that the elections are going to the, you know, the critical part to the elections is the Electoral Amendment Act, and that is going to slow the process, and I think that possibly some time can be created for you to work on that. But then the other alternative is to be generous with the NCOP. If they find additional amendments, then when it comes to the Reconciliation Committee to you know, give them that opportunity for a second chance to fix this thing. The other way one can do it is to maybe reduce some of the more ambitious things in this act and leave it to another additional act that could be done afterwards if there isn't time to work through all of the detail here. So thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you very much. I've noticed that you keep on saying we don't have enough time to deal with the bill. We can work 24 hours. So I think the team that is here can manage. Maybe if I was to start, I haven't heard you recommending on the definition on threat to national security. My understanding would be that when the intelligence service start investigating a person, it means that person is a suspect, not that the person is guilty. And anybody can be a suspect, starting from Bushiri, and he's a church person, there's Omtoso, a church person, but if you are being investigated, it means you are a suspect. And according to me, it means any citizen can be a suspect to be investigated and cleared at some stage. So what would be your suggestion on this, on the threat itself? Any other questions from the members? Honorable Stebe.
Chair, I saw here that there was mention made. It's on. They were referring to bring CIRA under this legislation. What is your stance on that, and how do you see that?
Any other questions? Honorable Hadebut and H.
Thank you, Chair. And I was also interested in getting to understand, according to your understanding, what do you think is the reasonable time for us to apply our mind in order for you to arrive at the conclusion that we have extensively dealt with on these issues. You kept on saying you were informed, you were told that we will be sitting. You seem to have reference to other information. But the section that you're saying you must remove any opportunity, my understanding that it's in reference to Section 198. So any opportunity that will advance Section 198, does that not give comfort to you? Because when I'm reading the definition, it's any opportunity in or outside the Republic in accordance to Section 198. So anything outside that, it will be inconsistent with the issues that you have raised. So you're also proposing that in the definition of threat to national security, we must completely remove Section A and B. So you don't regard those two as threat to national security. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Maybe to add on your question on opportunities, I understand opportunity to mean that the intelligence services, especially foreign, look around for opportunities, whether it be the economy and the advice. That is my understanding. Maybe if we were to get your understanding of opportunity, might be cultural opportunities for the country, economic opportunity. I don't take it as something negative. Maybe let's get your understanding. Can we have Honorable Hendricks?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Honorable Chair, the organization represents 70 Christian organizations, and we must not take their views lightly. They refer to intrusiveness of the legislation. They also refer to a threat of freedom, in other words, suggesting that spies are going to intrude into our lives and they are a threat to our freedoms. And one can just think about what spies did when you read the TRC reports and the harm that they cause. So I also think of the Immorality Act, where spies were intrusive and used to, in the middle of the night, peep through bedrooms to make sure that whites and blacks don't kiss. But having said that, it'd be interesting to hear whether they feel that this intrusiveness and also the issue around freedom, which we fought hard for, does national security trump the right to freedom and also the right not to have this intrusiveness in our daily lives? Interesting to hear their view. That will help me when we deliberate on this later on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And maybe if I was to clarify one thing, with the presentation, it's not either we or them. I think with the presentations, we are all on the same side, because what we are trying to do here, the bill is trying to correct things that were wrong, that were said by the Zondo Commission, the high-level review panel. That is what all of us are trying to correct. So the presentations maybe mustn't be as if there's somebody resisting. The presentations must be to help and enhance the bill itself. I thought it was important to mention that. Over to you. Or maybe on one thing, maybe the vetting. Let me get the views on the vetting. Usually there's a very thin line between vetting, as in taking a person for lie test and getting into the person's previous life and so on. But if we talk about lifestyle audit, it's part of vetting. And if you investigate a person in terms of some of the things, you will have to do a lifestyle audit, which is vetting. Maybe there's a bit of a very thin line on that. Maybe if you could get into that, because vetting itself might be broad, or maybe you suggest that the term itself be changed to assessment of a person or whatever. Over to you. Before that, Can we have follow-ups, Honorable Luate, and followed by Honorable Hadero with an H?
Yes. Chair, I just wanted a little bit more clarification, if I understood it well, on the issue of the education department spying on an education institution. Could you elaborate more what would that mean in relation to national security?
Honorable Hadebe.
I wanted to get your views in relation to the section 8B that is in Master Wu. I'm sure you recall the first alarm by the U.S. so-called embassy on the Sentinel matter, where they said there was a threat to Sentinel. Would you regard that as not falling under B? I'm sure you recall the incident of the first alarm that caused a very serious and untested security alert. Thank you so much.
Any other question? Over to you for the answers.
Thank you. Okay, I'll start trying to go through them in the order in which they were asked. The first question is just the question of the person being a suspect and not being found guilty. I would accept that, although I would note that this bill does give powers to apprehend a person, which is a considerable power, and that doesn't go through, have the checks and balances in terms of the constitutional rights to arrest. So that, you know, that is a concern. Then there's also the big difference between vetting, which is prior, and investigation, which is after somebody has done something that then is flagged, then you investigate after that. With the case example of Bushiri, who was a foreign prophet, who called himself a prophet, came into this country and then was accused of exploiting people's money and such like. I believe that this bill would, even if you took out Section A and B, it would still give powers to for these security or the police to investigate such a person, because it talks about money laundering and such like. I think that would, one wouldn't even remove that from the net. But what we definitely don't want is, I think, what was proposed in 2016 by somebody at the CRL Rights Commission of vetting of every religious leader before they are kind of allowed to practice. We don't want that. If somebody is doing something or suspected of doing something, yes, you can investigate, but not vetting is something that needs to be much narrower. And I believe that without Section A, without number A and B, there are plenty enough criteria to investigate accused religious leaders if they are doing something wrong. And I certainly don't want to stop that investigation. There are religious leaders who do terrible things and make threats of violence and whatever. Those people must be investigated, but not everybody. Not automatically. I'm going to skip over Mr. I'm going to ask you, could I ask for quick clarification if Mr. Stipper could just say that name, S-I-R-A, in full? What was the... Oh, okay. Then... yes, that thing. I think the May draft of this bill said that the gave powers to co-opt private security, which would be very dangerous. In the new draft, it said that they would indirectly then co-opt the private independent security regulator. And to me, that I wouldn't say entirely no to that, but I would like to know more detail of exactly what the intention is there and how that's going to be controlled, because that is an enormous power. That industry is bigger than the combined forces of the military and the private security. And if it was to happen, as is happening in China, that state got access to every security camera and the tracking of the movements of license plate numbers, then that would be dangerous. And I'm told that the Chinese are undertaking tests in Zimbabwe with the cooperation of the Zimbabwean government, so I don't think it's unrealistic that that could be abused. And so I think there needs to be controls there. I mean, sure, you can increase powers, but then it must be balanced to make sure it's not abused. Then the second question, just in terms of what is a reasonable time, in terms of the Honourable Hadebe and the Chairman, I saw as an example, the hate speech bill. The Parliamentary Committee worked from November 22 through to about April 23 to try and iron out problems there, and I think they did a lot of good deliberation. They still didn't iron out all the problems, and there was many serious problems still remaining when it went to the NCOP, and those still weren't sorted out. So that would be even with that generous amount of time, which is much more than what is here, I can't see this being well deliberated on. With the Bella Education Bill, the committee ended up receiving the summary of the public participation the night before they were due to vote on this thing, and the committee members, certainly from the opposition, protested that they hadn't had time to read and digest the summary, which was itself an enormous document before that decision was made. And I expect that will be constitutionally challenged, because I know organizations that are intending to do that. And to me, this time frame of trying to squeeze this in are very, very tight. I would say the committee, at the absolute minimum, would need a month to go through the process of firstly reading this fat document full of all these submissions, plus the other summaries of the by the parliamentary assistants, and then they're going to have to extract from that the best and put those into alternatives with the help of the state law advisor. Then they're going to need to deliberate on each one of them, and in the best scenario, that to me that would take months, but maybe 1 month you could do that in before you make a decision, that if you do work 24 hours. But I'm frightened about something slipping through, because this bill to me is still at the first draft stage. It needs lots more work. Then the next question of the issue of the limit or the section 198 being used as a limitation for opportunities. I don't see this section 198 as a real limitation. It is so broad that in my view it limits the scope of the security services total, not just this particular service of the spy agency, and what is within there is enormously broad. But to me, opportunity, I can interpret just about anything. You give me something you want to do, and I will give you an argument about why you can do that as an opportunity. I'm sure some clever lawyer can do that as well. So to me, opportunities, if the security agencies want the word opportunity in the bill, then I would ask them to come back and explain what they mean there, and then we can think about a way of putting that in a more narrow way. To me, if you want to do research on economic opportunities, you don't need the spy agency to do that. You can just make some phone calls and use the internet. One doesn't need to be using the powers of mass surveillance or these special powers which are being given or secret services. So we don't need that to explore economic opportunities. The spy agency needs to be limited to threats, the second issue is that I don't think that by narrowing the focus, one is going to weaken the work of these people against legitimate threats. I think you will strengthen them, because their focus will not be diversified onto other things that are irrelevant. I think we do need national security to be investigating threats to in terms of money laundering and threats in terms of violence to make it safer for everybody. But they don't need to be wasting their time investigating NGOs and potential political people who disagree with the government, unless they are making threats of violence, in which case then I would change the argument. Then to come to Mr. Honourable Hendricks's question about self-regulation of religion to the previous speaker, I would agree with him that it needs to be independent, but in fact, in terms of religion, it needs to be more independent than the professions, because the professions are ultimately accountable to the state because they are organs of state, whereas the church denominations are not organs of state, and they shouldn't be organs of state. There needs to be a separation, as per the teaching of the Bible, between the church and the state, so that we would resist any such state control indirectly through a self-regulating body. We do have self-regulating bodies, but the state's only concern needs to be if there are things like threats of violence or money laundering, as espionage, which are a separate issue. They don't need to include everybody in the dragnet. And just to give some history to this, the person who first proposed a limited state was a man by the name of Roger Williams, who was a British lawyer and politician and pastor who was forced to flee England because of the intrusive state of the control of the king. He then went to America and ended up with the same problem with a religious state in Massachusetts. And when he proposed that one needed to have separation of church and state, they threw him off. So he went to the Indians, and he persuaded with the Indian chiefs that they would support a new state that was independent of the government. And his proposal was that the state should be like the sailors of a ship, that don't interfere with the religious activities of the people on the ship unless they interfere with the actual running of the ship. Then the question of in terms of the chair asked, in terms of vetting and the level of intrusiveness, should we change the term? I think the purpose of vetting is if somebody is given special powers by the state, such as control over money or military power, then there is reason to vet them. But there's no reason to prior vet somebody who's involved in an NGO or a religious organization. Vetting is beforehand, investigation is after something is suspected, and I don't, even with a softened word, I don't want any kind of prior vetting of religious or NGO leaders. Then in terms of Honourable Luwate, elaborate what one means in terms of national security. Sorry, Honourable Luwate, could you elaborate on what your question was there?
Well, if I heard you correctly in your remark, you showed some reservations in an investigation or spy by an education department or an education organization.
Okay.
So, you know, taking that organizations have got some kind of influence
mm-hmm.
In whatever they teach.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted you to elaborate your understanding on that.
Okay. I think I would give the... I would maybe move across from education, and we had a situation actually in this parliament in a room not very far away from here where, for example, in the health department, one had an amendment law being proposed, and one had a group of non-profit organizations that were opposed to the law. And we had a chairman of the committee who was only allowing NGOs that he agreed with to give submissions to the committee. And the other NGOs that were opposed to this then came as observers, and expressed their unhappiness at not being allowed to speak by putting tape over their mouths. This made him very angry, and he then threatened them with investigation, with national security, and had security remove them from the committee meeting. Now, that is just an example of a conflict between some NGOs that have an interest in the health, what the health department is doing, that you don't want the state to be spying on them. Likewise, there are disagreements between, for example, the homeschooling movement and the Department of Education. They are having lawsuits, you know, to try and settle their differences. But one wouldn't want somebody in the education department who wanted to investigate homeschooling then be spying on those organizations. And the same could be done. Department of Communications could be, you know, spying on their members. You know, any kind of information needs to have sort of warrant for investigation. And I can see, as said before, these criteria, if there's threats of violence or money laundering or misuse of state contracts or something like that, then by all means investigate, but not throw the net wide. And I don't think that's going to weaken the actual legitimate work of the spy agency. It will strengthen it, because it will keep them more focused. And one can say the same for just about every government department has some NGOs that are disagreeing with what they're doing, and that's part of the healthy process of a liberal democracy. But that dynamic has completely broken down in places like Russia or China, where these groups are intimidated and cannot exert the influence that they want because of this kind of intrusive spying and such. Then the question on the false alarm, I'm sorry, I'm unaware of that, but I will research that and I will submit a written comment once I've researched it to understand what that false alarm was about.
Thank you very much. Honorable Hadewe, follow-up?
I think, yes, Chair, based on your response that you don't think there is a need to vet church leaders, and the chair made an example about Bushira.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to add.
It's your mic on?
Yeah,
yes,
it's highly odd.
Very highly odd.
Is your
voice on? I wanted to just make a follow up on the response of church leaders. You say you don't feel the need to be vetted.
Mm-hmm.
And the chair made an example of Bushir. I also wanted to make an example about, I'm sure you're aware of the church in Eastern Cape, Engqobo, where they attacked a police station and seven something. Based on those experiences, you still maintain the view that there is no need for vetting to be undertaken, given such past experiences that we've experienced. One of those church leaders was sentenced to more than 200 years in prison for storming and killing police and using church for illegal activities. Thank you.
Just to answer that question, thank you.
Maybe if I was to add on that question, because I had the question myself, there will be the commission on religious, cultural, and so on. But still, with there are churches that disagree with the commission, their approach, and so on. We cannot all agree on that. And maybe to add intelligence, my understanding is that they are proactive. They are trying to stop something from happening. And so, as I said earlier, if there's a suspect, they will have to go after the suspect. But if the suspect is cleared, then there's no problem. That's my understanding. But in any way, I would say the presentation has been given, and it's going to be deliberated on, and those that are specific views that are specifically referring to the bill itself will be inserted if that is so not that I'm suppressing any view, but that's what I think the whole process is all about. Do you still want your question answered, Honorable Hardevoit and H?
No, I'm covered, Chair, but I just wanted to bring to the fore that there are many instances where intelligence could have intervened and avert instances of disaster from occurring. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we agree. Can I then thank the presenter and say that the views will be deliberated on, and what needs to be inserted will be inserted, what needs to be removed will be removed, depending on the deliberations. Thank you very much. 5 minutes break before the next. Thank you very much. The next presentation will be from AfriForum. We already had two presentations from the FWD Club Foundation and by Association of Christian Media, just to inform the presenter of AfriForum. Over to you, the presenter. Do we have the presenter online from AfriForum?
I'm here, Chair. Can you hear me?
Very clearly. Over to you.
Excellent. Chair, thank you. I guess the appropriate thing to say under these circumstances would be thank you for the opportunity. But I'm going to be honest with you and say that I'm concerned that this is simply be pandering to the process. You see, Chair, I've made many submissions like these in the same way that AfriForum has been making submissions like these for many years. And I'm afraid that just like the National Health Insurance Act, the expropriation of that compensation bill, and the Basic Education Laws amendments, these amendments are simply going to be steamrolled through the parliamentary process, ignoring the thousands of well-argued comments against doing that. Because unfortunately it fits the African National Congress's ideal of clinging to power through all means. I'm still waiting for the ruling party to table a law that will prevent children from drowning in pit toilets, Chair. I'm still waiting for the sleeping cabinet ministers to increase the budget for visible policing while decreasing the budget for their own VIP protection. I'm still waiting to see the ANC admit to their role in state capture and prosecute murderers of whistleblowers like Obito Tiukara, whose cell phone was traced and monitored for weeks, ironically, before her brutal murder. And now the South African public is being asked to sign off on laws that will give this government even more powers to trace and track people's cell phones, for instance. Chair, as the philosopher Credo Mutswa so wisely asked, do dirty pots bring forth clean food? And the answer is no, they do not. These amendments are the dirty food that has been brought forth by the dirty pot, which is the African National Congress government. Chair, I do not have faith in this process because the party behind it all are con artists tricking the populace into believing that they have a say and pretending to follow the guidelines of the South African Constitution. And so, we will make our submission, yet again, if that is what is required of us to keep the record straight. But should these laws be pushed through, AfriForum will be ready to challenge them in court, as we are ready to challenge all the other pieces of unconstitutional legislation
that's currently lying on Cyril Ramaphosa's desk waiting to be signed into law just before election time. I will summarize our concerns, Chair, seeing as I've said that we have made these submissions verbally and extensively in detail written here before. Our concerns are the following. Expansion of vetting powers. This broad definition of personal institution of national security interest raises concerns about freedom of association and privacy. Chair, it does not take a very long stretch of the imagination to see how the ANC government can abuse widely phrased terms like these to target political rivals as well as activists. Chair, you yourself have been the victim of political incarceration, and I'm sure that's something you would not want to see repeated in a democratic South Africa. Lack of oversight. The bill lacks adequate oversight of surveillance, which could lead to unchecked surveillance powers and potential abuses. Now, we know that currently, should members of the Hawks or a police detective agency want to trace and monitor someone's phone calls, they need permission from a High Court judge. But that is at least one check and balance that we currently have in place, even though that has also been circumnavigated in certain circumstances. The law as it stands at the moment, the amendments do not leave much of a check or balance regarding that, and it's clear that it can be easily abused. Failure to address SSA issues. The bill does not address historical challenges within the SSA, such as strengthening the independence of the Inspector General of Intelligence and preventing abuses and corruption. Chair, we know that a former sitting president of this country weaponized the SSA to his own advantage. We also know that a former minister in charge of the SSA has been linked to rhino horn poaching and human smuggling without any proper investigations being made into those accusations. So that is extremely concerning and things that this bill should address. And lastly, Chair, privacy and freedom of association. Our report is concerned about potential threats to privacy and freedom of association. The vague definitions of expansive powers in the GILAD could result in arbitrary applications and abuses. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Maybe if I was to start with questions and maybe even comments. My understanding is that if there's to be something intrusive to the citizens, we have got a judge, the intelligence services or agencies have got to apply to a judge before they can do any intrusive activity against South African citizens. Don't you think that is enough for now? And what is your recommendation of strengthening the whole process? Other members, questions? Honorable Kola Bonnet.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. In the knowledge that the original bill that was circulated had in it compulsory vetting for heads of churches and NGOs, in that it's been taken out, in your reading of this current format that was sent to us by the Cabinet, do you see that it's been reintroduced through the back door, as it was? And is that your major concern, including, I understand that most people have raised the issue of the IG and strengthening the IG, but it's that one issue that is being raised over and over, all over, the threat to independent integrity, as it were. Your opinions on that, please.
Any other member? Over to you for answers.
May I respond, Chair?
Correct. You can respond.
Thank you. I think the impression is definitely being created that those same concerns are being re-implemented by backdoor policies. I think the fact that the law, that these amendments are not very clearly explicit on how those matters should be dealt with is very concerning. We've seen how this has played out in the past before, where certain decisions are made politically and they are trying to be enforced through legal matters. They're not successfully expunged and then are being tried to implement through other legal matters or through other legislation in different laws. So to respond to your question, I think that is the impression that we are getting regarding the re-implementation of the vetting and compulsive screening as well.
Thank you very much. Any other question from members? I need to say that this ad hoc committee is a multi-party ad hoc committee, not only the ANC. It's every party have got a right here to insert or to end the deliberations. Any other question? If not, then we need to thank our presenter. The presentation, all of the presentations are going to be part of a report that is going to be deliberated on as the other committee deliberates. Can I then thank you for your presentation? Oh, sorry. I'm told you didn't introduce yourself. Are you still there?
My name is Jacques Frederick, Chief Spokesperson for Community Safety at AfriForum.
Thank you very much. Can I just say, members, whilst we are still here, seemingly we have a quorum, and we wanted to request maybe a 1 week extension from Parliament, or 2 weeks extension from Parliament. Can you say something about that? The process?
Informed that another committee is also going through the same process.
So what we are doing now, we are having all these bills that need to be finalized by a certain date, go to get a service provider that will work on it. So the process itself takes a little bit time from when they made the actual amendment to the finalization of that bill. And we're hoping that we could get an extension to finalize that process so that by the time when the committee has to report to NA, you actually have that bill. So we need to have that bill, and members need to go through that bill to say, yes, this is what we actually want. Given the time that we have now and what is contained in the program, we do not have enough time, because based on the mandate of the ad hoc committee, this committee needs to report to NA by 1 March, which gives you exactly just over a week. And it's not possible because we're still having public hearings, oral submissions now. You still need to consider the public hearings report and the report on these oral submissions. So there's still more work that needs to actually happen to the physical amendments on the bill, where we have to go through all that was said. Actually, we have to go through the bill, working on those definitions that they are raising, each and every issue that is being raised. Our legal people are working on that, and when that process is done, after, because remember, now they are working on that based on the information that is coming through, making proposals, but the committee, the one that needs to sit and still decide on that. So based on the outcomes of the public hearings, these oral submissions, and the deliberations of the committee, following, of course, the responses from the department, that's when we will be in a position to have that proposed a list, and then the process will be completed like that, Chairperson. So that requires time. Even with this 2 weeks that we say is not nearly enough, but that's what we have, so that's what we will take. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. So we agree that we are going to request an extension. And the timelines, we don't specify, or how do we specify what we are asking for?
Okay, Chairman, so that will have to be specified by date. So now if it was a week from the first, the week will take us to the 8th. So we add another 7 from that, will take us to around the 15th of March. So if we are to request an extension to the speaker, would request, based on what the committee has resolved, will request the 15th of March. That is not guarantee that we'll get that, but that's what we're going to request, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any proposal for an extension? Honorable Stebe, any seconder?
Yeah.
Seconded by Honorable Kolapana. I think the date for the debate is determined by what is the process? They are going to give us a date. I think for now, if we can request for 2 weeks, we can manage it. I'm not very sure whether if we ask for 3 weeks, we might. Honorable Stebe.
I think it's going to be, we listen what has to happen, and then we still need to do it clause by clause, and the department must come back and give their input. So I can foresee that maybe 3 weeks is it's pushing. But let's ask for 3 weeks. If we get to that, we might ask for another extension. So what we have resolved is we are asking for 3 weeks. Okay. Can we do that today? Just to draft the letter.
Yes, Jefferson. The memo is ready. We'll just change the dates here and there.
Oh, you had already done it.
No, we're very proactive in our work, so we have everything ready and ready to go as and when requested, Chair.
Okay, I think that is done. By the way, we are on an open... sorry about that. Okay, Honorable Stebe.
Can we then take it 3 weeks from the first of the month, of the next month? Thank you.
We are not sure whether we are going to be given that, but that let that be in our request. I'm told then that Kotatu is ready. Maybe online or
online.
Okay. I'm told Kotatu is ready online. Then we are going to have the presentation by Kotatu. We already had a presentation from FW de Klerk Foundation, from the Association of Christian Media, and from AfriForum. Can I then hand over to Kotatu? Over to you.
Okay. Good morning, Chair. Good morning to honourable members. Hope you can hear me okay.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Chair, we want to thank you. Okay. Thanks very much, Chair. Apologies for being here virtual. Parliament is quite busy as we head to the final stretch of this administration. But I think we do want to appreciate the committee giving space to Kotatu just to share some of our views and some of our concerns around the bill. I think we can just go to the next slide. So, Chair, I mean, we do have some concerns about the bill in terms of the constitutionality, but also the possible impact of the bill and what could be unintended consequences. But having said that, there are also some parts of the bill which are simply straightforward and are supported. We were quite concerned about the initial draft of the bill, and I think we do appreciate that some of the concerns we had were removed in the subsequent draft, and that is appreciated. But we do have some concerns, Chair, still that the bill, we feel, doesn't sufficiently enhance the oversight role of the Inspector General. We also feel that it is still a little bit vague with regards to some definitions of threats to national security and also the issue of checks and balances that are on the bulk monitoring of communications. I think just to next slide. So, Chair, you know, our stance is Kotatu, you know, colleagues might ask, you know, why exactly does the Trade Union Federation care about intelligence bill? So, I mean, our stance, Chair, that, well, this affects all of society. You know, we are informed by the revelations of real abuses of the role of the state security and intelligence services in the past decade, during state capture, etc. And those abuses took place for personal, for criminal, for factional, for political purposes. I think all political parties have been equally concerned. And of course, you know, we are very worried about, you know, serious allegations of criminal activity that remain within the state security, the intelligence services, whether it's issues of theft or corruption. But it's also, of course, Chair, you know, these concerns are not assisted by the fact that we just don't see people who have been implicated in these criminal activities being held accountable in terms of prosecutions, etc. And I think, hence, you know, we did support also the high-level panel's recommendations specifically and what needs to be done, not just administratively, but also in terms of legislative overhauling of these institutions. The next slide. So, Chair, I mean, some parts of the bills we think are quite straightforward and we support them. So, you know, separating domestic and external intelligence capacities, I think that's straightforward. Formalizing the National Intelligence Academy, administrative, straightforward. So those are common sense. We support them. But again, Chair, we don't think they are addressing the challenges of the abuse of the state security in the recent past, as highlighted by the by the high-level panel. The next slide. Chair, we were really quite shocked when we saw the first draft last year. We just felt it was significant overreach, and we just would not pass constitutional muster. We were quite, you know, amazed that state security would not want to vet persons establishing religious institutions, NGOs, etc. And of course, we felt...
If I was to disturb you a bit, most of the presentations say initial draft bill. And maybe if I was to clarify that, that bill, according to Parliament or according to, we never received that bill. It was just in the open, but that is not the bill that was presented to Parliament. So according to us, this is the only bill that we know. So I just wanted to clarify that. You can continue.
Yeah. No, thanks, Chair. No, look, I think a point here was just to appreciate that the Department was responsive to criticism from society, and they removed, you know, those offensive clauses. That's positive. I mean, when government makes mistakes, we are correctly harsh, but I think also when departments respond to society's concerns, we should also acknowledge it and welcome that. So I think that's the point here, that they have made some efforts to address some of those concerns with the bill that's now before Parliament. I think just to next slide. So I think, Chair, where we're concerned is, you know, a couple of areas here. So there was, you know, there has been some effort to further tighten definitions of threats to national security. You know, we welcome that kind of efforts by government. We still think some clauses, I think two in particular with regards to definitions of threats to national security, are still quite vague. And, you know, this is going to make it a practical level difficult for the police to investigate. It obviously will make it quite complicated for the NPA to prosecute, and of course I think you will struggle to find convictions in courts around it. There's also a danger, Chair, when clauses are just simply vague. Of course they're going to be misinterpreted, it will create confusion. So we think, Chair, you know, there's a great opportunity now before the committee to see how we tighten up, clean up and clarify some of the definitions of threats to national security. Next slide. So, Chair, just in terms of the bill, you know, Section 1, Clause 1TA, so it says any activity that seeks to harm the advancement and promotion of equality and equitable access to opportunities by all South Africans, provided for in Section 9 of the Constitution. B, any activity that seeks to harm the advancement and promotion of peace and harmony, freedom from fear and want for South Africans. So that's fine. No one, I think, would disagree with these, you know, constitutional and legal provisions. But, Chair, how do you translate that into a possible criminal offence? That, we think, would be quite difficult. Yes, these are political objectives, etc. But I think, Chair, for the average police officer, it might be quite complicated to know what exactly constitutes an offence on these ones. So we think, Chair, that we would hope that there would be some appetite to significantly just tighten definitions and where they're relevant just to delete if they're simply just too vague. On next slide. The other clauses we felt were fairly clear and did also, you know, for example, qualify a constitutional threat, you know, like serious violence, etc. Chair, then we, you know, when we're following the committee deliberations, we appreciate that members did a lot of work and a lot of engagement. We were really quite concerned when Inspector General flagged concerns. We would really want to run that office of the Inspector General for guidance on many issues, given the levels of expertise and experience. So it was concerning one that they had not been part of drafting the bill. That was a significant concern, given their oversight and accountability role. I think also given that the current and previous occupants of that post have raised concerns about what they felt have been limitations on the powers, the ability to oversight, hold accountable intelligence services, etc. Chair, we also do feel that the bill hasn't addressed and really acted upon the key objectives of the high-level panel to clarify, protect, and enhance the powers of the OIGI. We do fear, for example, the clause that says, you know, the minister would appoint staff to the OIGI on behalf of the inspectors. It's given the impression that we're relegating the role of the Inspector General, and I think for us that that's quite concerning. Next slide. Pressure in our proposals here, it's a couple fold, and we do pressure through the committees under severe pressure because we're getting towards the end of the sixth parliament. There's not much time left in the calendar. Proposal basis was threefold. One is the Inspector General's office has made quite a few recommendations. One is we would support their inclusion in the bill. But we do feel there's a need for even greater work beyond that to really ensure we've incorporated the high-level panel's recommendations about addressing the legislative weaknesses that have been highlighted by current and previous incumbents of the OIGI with regards to the role of that office. And we think, Chair, we should really take the gap. If the Inspector General previously has raised concerns about as mundane administrative issues as appointing a PA and how they struggle on that kind of issue, that points to a broader challenge. So we think, Chair, this is a really ideal opportunity to see, you know, other ways to strengthen the role, the statutory authority, the organizational autonomy, the oversight and accountability role of the office, and also, you know, taking upon the precedence of the public protector's findings, can these findings remain binding to state security agencies? Our next slide. Then, you know, so one appreciates the need for intelligence services to engage in bulk communication monitoring. One appreciates the contradictions of the juggling act, etc. So the bill provides a really extensive powers for state security to undertake bulk monitoring of public and private communications. And one appreciates that that's part of the course of intelligence services. And so it does provide a role for judicial authorization, but we do fear that it doesn't provide sufficient checks and balances beyond that. Given that this is bulk communications, not just a question of one person or individual person, etc. It's mass bulk communication. And again, our fear, as has been shown in recent past, that this is open to abuse by individuals in the intelligence services. So that's our fear there, Chair. Next slide. So again, our proposal in this regard, Chair, that we would hope to, or support, you know, further strengthening provisions, which would oblige state security to provide greater motivation for such applications to the judges, to also institute continuous mechanisms for reporting to oversight authorities on such bulk monitoring, whether it's to the judges, whether it's to the Joint Standing Committee, to the Inspector General, etc. And I think also to limit such bulk monitoring to specific periods or instances as well. So next slide. Chair, then I think lastly, and again, one really does appreciate Parliament is under severe time pressure. But we are concerned that we've got a very sensitive bill. It's quite contentious across the political spectrum. Of course, you know, there are far-reaching consequences. We do fear that rushing the bill through the remaining 6 weeks, or give or take, of the National Assembly's term. We do fear the potential unintended consequences this could include. You know, it could, for example, include the weakening of the role of the Inspector General. There is a challenge of retaining vague and really difficult and possibly dangerous definitions of threats to national security. And, of course, our fears around the abuse of bulk communications monitoring. Next slide. So that's the final recommendations, Chair. In terms of the content of the bill, we would recommend tightening the definitions of threats to national security, strengthening the role and autonomy of the OIGI, including the recommendations that office has submitted, and of course also insert mechanisms or provisions to help prevent abuse of bulk communications monitoring. And then the last slide, Chair. And in terms of those processing, Chair, ideally one is to address those concerns, and we hope that our proposal would, you know, assist the committee in its work. We will propose, you know, redrafting the bill to address these concerns. If that can be done within this sixth parliament, fantastic. But we fear that we should rather focus on redrafting it and having a proper sound product in a day as opposed to simply trying to get things done within the remaining 6 weeks thereabouts of the parliamentary calendar. We will suggest, you know, redraft what can be done now and then, of course, continue after elections. And I fear, Chair, just to avoid a poorly drafted bill being rushed and, of course, then raising deep-seated concerns among society, et cetera, about possible abuse of security powers. So we think, lastly, Chair, you know, without us being too presumptuous, it's best to take time, fix the bill, address concerns, as opposed to rushing to get things done, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's it from our side, Chair, and hope that has assisted all the members, and thanks for giving us space to share our views, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We can then come with clarifications, questions. On the presentation, maybe if I was to start on slide number 10, bullet point number 1 says, bill allocates extensive powers for state security to undertake bulk monitoring of public and private communications. Maybe if I was to ask, my understanding of bulk interception or bulk monitoring, that is done externally, it's not done for the citizens of this country. And it definitely deals with signals. My understanding is that it's simply a harvesting of signals that are there in order to identify those that might be a threat to the country. It's not actually dealing with the public. That is my understanding. Maybe if you could tell us your understanding in relation to that. And one other thing, I can't see where it is, but it's talking about the NPA and I think it's slide number 6. Vague definitions of threats to national security will make it difficult for subs to investigate, NPA to prosecute, and courts to convict. My understanding is that the intelligence services don't usually go to court, and whatever they gather, they take to the relevant structures to investigate and to prosecute. How then will that make it difficult for SAPS to investigate? Meaning that if they don't have enough information that has been supplied by the intelligence agencies, the NPA would say go back and do 1, 2, 3, because what do we have here doesn't give us a chance to prosecute. Especially because members of the intelligence services don't usually go to court to give evidence. That's why they are called spooks. So I don't see how that can make it difficult for NPA and SAPS and the courts. Open to members, Honorable Kolabana.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm most interested in your phrase that you were surprised that the Inspector General was not included in the drafting. I'm not sure who determined who should draft it, but he certainly did give extensive inputs at the outset when we began this process, and I think virtually everyone has raised the same issue, that according to the High Level Review Panel report, it said very clearly that his position needs to be strengthened. So I think we've taken that on board. But it's an interesting concept that he should have been there for the drafting. Where would you have got that from? I don't even know. In fact, I can't tell you why he wasn't. But interesting concept. Thank you.
Any other question or clarifications? If not, can I hand over to you for answers?
No, thanks very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I think it's basically three questions. So on the issue of bulk communications, so when you look at the bill, it speaks to under monitoring bulk communications. One is photo signals, as you mentioned, Chair, but also includes this broad thing of communications and non-communications. Very, very broad, Chair. We would understand communications, we hope, you know, we can be wrong, but communications, we understand, would include all forms of communication. And I think the fact that it says communication, non-communication, given a broad thing. And look, we understand the logic that, you know, materials need to gather information from all possible communications, so that's not an issue of dispute. I think what the sense is that, fine, you apply to the two judges, fine, and then what? We think with this space and need, given our recent history, to see can we further tighten on the motivating criteria to the judges? Can we look at tighter time frames, etc.? Because right now, we think, you know, and we understand intelligence must gather information, that's fine, there's no dispute about that. But can we have a bit stronger checks and balances? And Chair, not because we're speaking from, you know, theoretical possibilities. I think we've all seen quite publicly the abuses that have been reported in the media, etc., in the past decade plus, Chair. Chair, on the issue of the threats, evolutions of threats to national security, look, one appreciates, you know, you would need a little bit broad, fine. So, but I think the point is, what you've raised is actually the point we were trying to raise. So state security will present a docket to the police, to the NPA. We would struggle with these broad definitions, which says any activity that seeks to harm the advance and promotion of equality, equitable access to opportunities, by all South Africans as provided for in the Constitution, or any activity that seeks to harm the advancement and promotion of peace and harmony and freedom from fear and want for South Africans. Those are very, very broad things. And yes, Chair, you're right. You know, so the police and the NPA can simply say, just security, there's not a convincing docket, go and rework it, etc. But Chair, shouldn't the purpose be that come with as tight as the bill as possible to avoid that kind of scenario? I think to Honourable Colonel Barnard, so we had raised the issue of OIG, because one, he publicly was quoted as saying he was not involved in the draft. That concerned us, because we would understand that the normal drafting of legislation from a department would include the relevant state organs in that sector. So that for us is a bit strange. But, you know, that could, in an instance, could be just an administrative mistake, okay? But given how the previous and the current OIGIs have raised alarm bells about not or struggling to exercise their role, etc., given the consequences society has faced because of their difficulties, given the high-level panel's recommendation on the need to strengthen their role, etc., that was just quite concerning that they were not part of it. And in fact, you know, some of the things, the articles we had seen in the media, which is that, well, they should simply go to the parliamentary process to make the comments. We don't think the OIGA is simply another NGO or JOSOP, and there's nothing wrong with JOSOP in the public or COSATU, etc. They've got a vested legislative oversight role. They're a creature of law, the Constitution, etc. We feel they should have been part of the process from day one. And look, it's helpful that, you know, we're just assuming it's to help the members to do their work, or assist members in their functions, because they're given certain recommendations. But we don't see, Chair, what in the bill actually is going to address the high-level panel's concerns. We don't see anything in it. Speaks to the minister appointing staff in office, and that's about it. So I think for us that's quite concerning. And we also feel, Chair, that would be a real missed opportunity if we didn't come out of this bill when something is said to the public. We've heard the concerns, we've seen the abuses, there was a high-level panel, etc., we've seized the moment, and we're strengthening the role of the state. Separating domestic and foreign intelligence is fine, establishing a National Intelligence Academy is fine, etc. Many other issues are administrative, that's great. But if you can get one positive transformational aspect out of it, it would really be about strengthening the role of the Office of the Intelligence Inspector General. And we just feel right now, Chair, in terms of the bill, we're missing that moment. So I think that's our fundamental concern, Chair. So I hope that assists yourself and all members, Chair. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. If I was to comment on some of the items in your presentation, or not only your presentation, almost most of the presentations, it seems people tend to think that nothing has been happening in relation to the high-level review panel and in terms of the Zondo Commission. But if I was to give an example, Parliament is busy doing that, implementing the recommendations of the Zondo Commission specifically, and the portfolio committees have been doing that in relation to the intelligence services. The Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence has been doing that, implementing some of the recommendations already. So it wouldn't be a new thing when it comes to the legislation itself. So some of the things have already been implemented, and we have been worried about that. If I was to comment on the IGI issue, the IGI reports to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, and some of those things have been highlighted. And maybe to come to my question of implementation of the recommendations of the IGI, well, recommendations can be binding anyway, but whether the IGI agrees with the minister to sign off the certificates, but he still reports to the committee, and the committee can come up with binding I don't know how to call it, but they can, whatever the IGI says, is taken to the minister, and the committee can make those recommendations binding. Don't you think that is enough? Because in any way, the IGI reports to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence. The IGI doesn't give orders to these services. Whatever he or she has, it has got to be reported to the JSCI, and the implementation comes from there. Do you think that is not enough? If it's not enough, what needs to be strengthened in relation to that? That was a very long question. I'm sorry about that. Any other question? Over to you.
No, thanks, Chair. No, I really appreciate the question. So, I mean, Chair, you know, look, we appreciate we're still a maturing democracy. Yes, we've made mistakes. Some of our mistakes have been very unfortunate. But I think we also appreciate the role of the Parliament, too, is evolving. And all of us are learning from our experiences and so forth, real consequences. But I think, Chair, we can't, you know, understate the amount of abuses we have seen in our intelligence services, not just state security, but I think we've seen your intelligence, crime intelligence, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's the kind of disappointment in the bill. We don't see what in the bill is actually going to really address those kind of things. And I want to appreciate the role of Parliament. And look, of course, Chen, you're 100% correct. You know, the Joint Standing Committee would have been doing a lot of work throughout the year. Very few people would know about it because, you know, the nature of this committee meetings is they're closed, they're secret. The society won't know if there's progress or if there's not progress or what's being done. And perhaps, you know, there's an element of communication that government or parliament would need to do at the appropriate time. But Chair, I think for us is that we've had a very good high-level panel. It said strengthen the role of the OIGI. So we don't see what in this bill strengthens it. We've had current and previous the incumbents of the OIGI expressing very deep frustrations. If you look at some of the reports, I think the high-level panel highlighted that half of the findings of the OIGI were ignored by state security. There might be general reasons why some of them wouldn't be actionable, it's fine, but that's still a large number, and it's still quite winning. Not because it is, you know, one out of two were ignored, but I think there's about 300 findings and about half of them were ignored. That's a significant amount of findings. So I think, and look, you know, Parliament itself, like any other institution of human beings, will make mistakes and not be perfect, etc. But you know, how can you sing the role of Parliament one? How can you sing the role of the OIGI? We don't think, Chair, we should simply say that, well, Parliament can perform its function. There's not a need to strengthen OIGI. I think, Chair, we'd rather strengthen both. They can be complementary towards each other, etc. And of course, you know, the OIGI would have much more space and time to get involved in the mundane issues of the state security. Parliament, by its nature, wouldn't have this. Members of the committee would have other responsibilities. They would not be able to get involved in the nitty-gritty, etc., individual instances, etc. So I think for us, Chair, it would really be a missed opportunity if we didn't find a way to strengthen the role of the OIGI to enhance its institutional autonomy. But Chair, there's value in making its findings have some teeth, have some weight. If state security can simply just choose to ignore it, then what is the point of it? You know, it's a bit like saying, well, let's appeal to the conscience of persons who are breaking the law, who are undertaking misdemeanors, etc., and hoping we can persuade them by moral persuasion. That's a bit of a gamble, Chair. And of course, the nature of the work of the state security, of the OIGI, of the Joint Committee itself, is that it's behind closed doors. So it's not like, with regard, you know, if you compare it to work of a Parliament with regards to Department of Public Works or Department of Transport or whomever, where you have an element of naming and shaming, public embarrassment, cajoling, etc. State security, you don't have that. So really, there are consequences. And I think, as you know, the fact that the OIGI says, well, they're not involved in the drafting, they're concerned about that. The fact that incumbents say we can't even appoint a PA, I think it just indicates to us, not that we're concerned about PAs, but I think it indicates to us that there's a problem, and here's a great opportunity to address that problem. It may not be the last opportunity, but I think for us, our plea to honourable members is that let's exploit this moment. Let's really try to do justice to the high-level panel's recommendations. But I think for us, Chair, it would be really a travesty if we didn't exploit this opportunity, Chair. Hope that assists to answer your question. Thanks, Honourable Chair.
Thank you very much. Do we have any other questions, comments, anything on that? Maybe if I was to comment, which I think is relevant, should I talk about myself personally? I would agree on the administrative part, that is the first thing that must happen to the IGI. The finances, his staff or her staff, having his own IT system separate from SSA, those are administrative issues, and I don't think anybody wouldn't agree with that. You can't share those things with people who you are supposed to be doing oversight on. You can't ask money from a person in order to investigate him. When it comes to those issues, I don't think we've got a problem. In fact, Parliament has always been saying that, or it doesn't work correctly on this. But on some other issues, those will be deliberated as from the inputs. I wouldn't like to say anything on that. For the last time, any other thing? If not, then we thank our presenter. All the inputs are going to be taken into consideration. when the deliberations are made into the final. Thank you very much, and you are excused or released, whichever or both. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay. There we are. Can we be, where do we go from here? Siakotanje or HIV? Okay. Can I then declare the meeting closed for today, and then we'll be, tomorrow, what are we dealing with tomorrow? If we, who do we have?
Thank you, Chairperson. Tomorrow we have 4 SAs.
We have?
4 SAs. Congratulation. Oh, yes, the first one will be the former IGI, Dr. Dietwe.
Okay.
And then we have 4 SAs.
Mm-hmm.
DS South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And Jane Dunford. So we have 5 presentations tomorrow.
Okay. It doesn't matter in what order they will be. Okay. Did I think the meeting was closed?
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, Chair. Tomorrow we had to start at 8 o'clock because we, because of Dr. Dintre.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no,